702-326-1642. That's 702-326-1642. Text your questions in. I'll be sharing those with Eric towards the end of the Q&A part. I'd like to welcome and introduce you to Eric Muldrow. Eric has been coming to the stream for about a year or so, and we're so thankful to have him as a member, and I'm so thankful for his expertise. He is the founder of Code Red Conversations, which is a series of YouTube videos to educate the public about things related to police brutality through the topic that he's talking about this morning. So with no further ado, let's give Eric a hand, and he's going to tell you more about his background. And thanks. Thanks for being here, Eric. Welcome.
Mic check. Okay, awesome. How's everyone today? Good. All right. Well, I want to say thank you all for being here on this fine, dusty, windy Sunday morning still. Yes, Sunday morning. I want to say thank you, Pastor Kevin, and the elder staff here at the stream for affording me this opportunity to come out here and give this presentation. I will do my best to stay on script because I can be long-winded. I like to talk. And I know time is limited today. So let's get rolling here. We're living in some pretty crazy times. I think we'd all agree on that, wouldn't we? I'm going to be asking for feedback, so I don't want dead silence when I'm asking y'all questions. We're living in some crazy times, aren't we, folks? Thank you very much. So let's make this fun. Seriously, I will be asking you guys questions, and I would like to get a little feedback if it doesn't put you out too much, okay? But I don't take the weight of these topics. How can I raise this up? There we go. Much better. Yeah, I don't take the weight of this topic lightly at all. I know that this topic can be both controversial and highly emotional. And my desire is never to offend, although I'm sure there will be moments that I will make pretty much everyone feel a little uncomfortable at one point or another, regardless of where you stand on the issue of police brutality and the entire social justice movement. During my time with you, I'll be speaking with you on the issue of police brutality and seeking to separate the facts from the fiction, while offering some advice as how we, the general public, should examine the often confusing topic of a police use of force. A little bit about me and my background. After leaving the U.S. Army in 1992, I'll be reading a little fast because I know we're on a tight schedule here, so bear with me, please. Shortly after that, at the age of 22, I began working for the Indiana Department of Corrections as a corrections officer from 1992 to 1995, a medium security prison, but I had the quote unquote pleasure of being assigned to the maximum security housing unit. To add a bit more context, Westville, Indiana is about 30 to 50 miles outside of Gary, Indiana, and Chicago, Illinois. And at that time, Gary held the distinction or the status of being the murder capital of the US for multiple years in a row. And Chicago, well, all anyone has to do is turn on the news to understand the unfortunate state of affairs in the city of Chicago. As challenging as the job was, I would say that's where I learned the skills that helped me more than any other throughout my law enforcement career. Skills that I honestly wish more officers would take the time to develop. And those skills were communication and persuasion. In a prison or jail environment, you don't have a gun. You might be lucky if you have a taser or a pepper spray. Oftentimes, it is you, a set of handcuffs, a radio, and your ability to communicate, or lack thereof. Think about it for a moment. You can be dealing with someone who's looking at 10, 15, even 30 plus years for violent felony offenses. And you are tasked to maintain order and control in your housing unit. How do you convince that person to make up his bed when he doesn't want to? I mean, think about it. You're in prison for 30 years, 50 years, and you got some guy, some 22-year-old telling you to make your bed. Seriously, it's nuts when you think about it. But there's always a bigger picture because you want that order, you want that control. I guess you can get physical, you can snatch him up and try to force him to do it, but not without creating a whole host of other problems. You have to be able to talk sensibly and rationally in order to get them to cooperate. But that's a story for another day. In 1996, after moving to Las Vegas and doing casino security for about a year, I hired on with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, which I'll refer to as LVMPD or Metro pretty much from here on out. I hired on there as a corrections officer, which I did for about 10 years. In 06, I decided I needed a change and attended the Metro Patrol Academy to become a police officer, and I finished out my career as a cop with Metro in 2014 when I retired. Over those years, I was blessed to work in a variety of different capacities. A little bit about me, I'm gonna speed through it for the sake of time. Well, just throughout my whole law enforcement career, I worked in the prison emergency squad. I worked in gang intelligence. I was a defensive tactics, firearms, active shooter instructor, terrorism liaison officer, crisis intervention team officer and coordinator. This is not an article. I won't get into all the details, but this came out in about 1993 or so on, 1993, 94. And it was an article about the conditions at the prison that I worked at. And it, to summarize it, there was a former inmate who got out and he was related to someone in politics. And he just bore his heart out about the horrendous conditions that he dealt with. It was really bad. But it was a blessing in disguise because it forced a lot of changes for the inmates and for the officers. Okay. There we go. This is my CO, Corrections Officer Academy, in 296. The arrow's pointing to my big old melon back there. Not one. There we go. Probably take more time just trying to change slides there than anything. This is my Patrol Academy graduation in 2007. Here I was nominated to give the class speech. And throughout my law enforcement career, I got to meet some pretty amazing people and do some pretty cool things. Whoa. Real close up there. And believe it or not, I did more than just take pictures. I actually fought crime on occasion. But throughout all the ups and downs, I would say that I loved what I did. I loved my career. And in my honest opinion, despite oftentimes what you may hear today, I believe that there are few jobs more honorable than that of a law enforcement officer. Protecting and serving can be extremely challenging, often thankless, and yet very rewarding. Huh, can you bring me those napkins? I left them over there. And the marker. Those of you who are familiar with me and my YouTube channel, Code Red Conversations, knows that I have no problem calling out the problems that have plagued law enforcement throughout its inception, and even now when necessary. Even if or when it puts me at odds with other officers, which happens often, I've always sought to be honest regardless of the consequences. Thanks, babe. Which brings me to perhaps the most profound example of that in my law enforcement career. While going through field training, which is basically on-the-job training for a police officer or a corrections officer. One of my field training officers instigated a conflict with an inmate. Why? I truly have no idea. I don't know if it was bravado or if he wanted to test me to see how I would respond, to see if I had what it took to do the job and to be an officer. But I remember him inciting an inmate, entering his cell, and with the assistance of another officer, basically brutalizing this man. I did assist in restraining him, but I refused to do anything else. I even remember the inmate, and it was a black inmate. He looked at me, didn't look at anyone else. He looked at me with blood pouring down his face, and he just said, "Man, how can you let them do that to me?" And I remember that just broke me and ate me up inside. And because you have to understand everything that was going on in our lives at the time. Here I was, the primary breadwinner for my family, having left a job, a security job that was paying me $7 an hour, to one that more than doubled my pay instantly. And if you factor in longevity and promotions, it can increase my pay 7 times that, probably even more. And add to the fact that my youngest daughter, Jasmine, in the back, looking all cute. She was 4 months old at the time, maybe. And I knew that this career could be life-changing for us. Well, I ultimately confronted my field training officer, and I challenged him as to why he did what he did. I told him that I wasn't a rookie to law enforcement. I had just got finished doing 3.5 years in prison, working, that is. Just for clarity's sake. I just did 3.5 years. So I knew the job. I knew what was needed. And I knew that there were times where you had to be physical and there are times where you didn't. Excuse me. Anyway, unfortunately, when it came down to it, it was my word against, and I had every bit of 24 hours on the job, my first day. So it was my word against the word of 2 seasoned officers. And so it went nowhere. And the only thing I got from it was basically gaining the reputation amongst the other officers as being a snitch. I remember going home to my wife and I broke down. I literally broke down in tears because I understood that this job could do so much for us. It was literally life-changing. But I also knew that if they wanted me, if this was how they wanted me to operate, I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it, and I would refuse to do it. Thankfully, with that incident behind me, I ultimately built my own reputation. No, I wasn't the perfect officer by any stretch of the imagination. But I'd like to think that those who truly knew me and knew how I worked, whether officer, citizen, inmate, or suspect, knew that regardless of our interactions, respect was always my primary goal. I say all this to say to you that yes, police brutality is a real thing. It does happen. I am not one of those who tries to say that it isn't. I believe that it would be an insult and a tremendous injustice to those who have suffered at the hands of those who have pledged to protect and serve. In the area of bigotry, I'm a kid of the 70s and 80s, so I think a lot of that is, we kind of already know where this is going. I can go on and on about how me and my family were often treated growing up in New Jersey by some of the white people in our community. Not all, but some. Especially consider the fact that we were the only black family who were there. It was often made very clear to us that we were not wanted, and we were not welcomed. From someone yelling the N-word at us at random as I walked down the street as a 7-year-old kid, not bothering anybody, to being cussed out by the police and basically being told that you're in the wrong blanking neighborhood and you need to go back to where you came from. It was almost a part of our everyday lives. But let me transition a little slightly. At school, where there was a lot more diversity, how do you think that went for us? Well, probably not how you think. For those that think bigotry and or racism, and I know there's like a modern definition these days, but traditionally speaking, those that think bigotry or racism can only come from white people, I would beg to differ. You see, we oftentimes we were accused of speaking too white. And on the flip side of that, I was oftentimes told that I was too dark, even for some of the other black kids. That's being real. And on many occasions, the teasing would escalate into threats of violence by kids who look just like me. I share all this with you to show you that my experiences are broad and I've seen bad come from all sides. I'd like to think that my life experiences puts me in a unique position to openly discuss these issues. I also think I'd be doing a huge disservice if I didn't recognize the massive, massive changes that have occurred in my lifetime amongst the various ethnic groups. Our culture has changed. I'm a living witness of that. In spite of what you may be hearing from the mainstream media, Hollywood, and other political pundits. Regarding our primary topic, the police. I would argue that for every occasion of police deception, misconduct, or carelessness, there are many others seeking to perform their job in a just manner. Voices and actions that are rarely heard or seen. One reason being that good news simply doesn't sell. In our desire to better understand the issues related to a police use of force, we must ask some tough questions. One, what is the reality of police shootings / brutality in our present day? Are cops out of control in regards to the killings of black men? Are things as bad as they were 30, 40, even 50 plus years ago? The data. What does the data show? What do the actual stats and numbers say about the police, and how does it compare to the mainstream media sources? News, so celebrities, so on and so forth. These are just some of the things we should seek to better understand before coming to any conclusion, one way or another. But before we go there, please allow me to take you on a little bit of a trip. You see the clock going backwards? A trip through history, if you will, as I seek to make my case. Eric knows you have a few slides for cops. You're halfway there. Okay, don't say anything yet. Okay, it's Q&A time. I want some public interaction. You may be dating yourself a little bit, okay? You might be. What's this? Oh, very good. Give yourself a round of applause. Very good, very good. What was that? Almost there, almost. This is the promotional poster for the movie Jaws. 1975. At least that's my research. I got it from Wikipedia, so it has to be right. But today, we're used to the big summer blockbuster movie, are we not? Every year, there's some big monster movie that comes out. But before Jaws, the general consensus was that people didn't want to be stuck in a movie theater during their summer vacations. Once again, the general consensus was that they would rather go on vacation and do different things, be at the beach, do things like that. But Jaws changed the game, becoming the first summer blockbuster. And shortly thereafter, became the highest grossing film in North American history. But yet, with all of that success, it also had an unexpected impact on the public. And we will be getting back to that, so keep that in the back of your mind. Whoops. Did I click something? There we go. At approximately in July 27, 1996, Atlanta, Georgia, at approximately 1 a.m., a nail-laden pipe bomb hidden inside a green backpack was discovered by security guard Richard Jewell. After alerting authorities, and while efforts were being made to clear the area, the bomb went off, killing Alice Hawthorne and injuring over 100 other people. During the initial investigation, Richard Jewell was credited with discovering the bomb and potentially saving countless lives. But that wasn't the end of the story. In March of 2006, during an off-campus party, members of the Duke lacrosse team invited some dancers over for entertainment. An argument ensued, resulting in the women leaving separately and early. One of the dancers, Crystal Mangum, pictured below, later stated that she had been dragged into the bathroom and was beaten and raped repeatedly by multiple members of the lacrosse team. What do these three events have in common? Let's do a bit of a review. This is where we bring it all together, start to bring it all together, y'all. So, whoops. I should click on that, it should play.
Summer of 1975, beach attendance fell nationwide. The drop in beach attendance was credited to both the success of the film, which saw millions of Americans flock to the cinemas, as well as the fact that it kind of made them scared to go in the water. Speaking of which, the film is still criticized today for painting an unnecessarily harsh and objectively incorrect picture of sharks, which hardly ever attack humans. However, the success of Jaws saw shark attacks not only being reported upon more often, creating the false impression that they were more common than they actually are, but also a more negative perception of the animal, which led to many of them being killed for no real reason.
You guys starting to see a little picture developing here? Mm-hmm. If not, stick with me. It's coming. Mm-hmm. A drop in beach attendance was credited to three different things. One, people viewing the film in droves. People weren't going to the beach like they were prior. Remember, it broke box office records. Two, many people became fearful of going into the water out of concern for a shark attack, which in all actuality is a very rare event. According to this slide, this is from the Florida 2003 International Shark Attack File. For Americans, the lifetime risk of dying from a shark attack is approximately 1 in 3.7 million. That means you have a greater chance of dying from heart disease, being killed by lightning, or experiencing death via fireworks. But at that time, you couldn't convince those people otherwise. They were terrified, partly because of what? The amount of media attention that was focused on a very rare event. Only, and when you get, let me continue on real quick before I get into that. A massive amount of media attention, once again, was thrust upon the idea of a shark attack, which fed the fear. That doesn't mean that sharks can't be harmful and that they aren't dangerous. But given the extreme rarity of these events, the fact that millions were afraid of going to the beach was without any true merit or warrant. Again, according to a study in 2002, only 3 people worldwide, as far as documented cases, were killed by shark attacks. A 2017 article stated that on average, sharks are responsible for, anyone care to guess, how many deaths a year? Give me a number. 12. Worldwide, 12 deaths a year. And that you are more likely to die from an elephant attack or a vending machine falling on you. For real. On the flip side, an estimated 26 to 100 million sharks are killed every year out of fear and for their fins. As I mentioned earlier, Richard Jewell was initially hailed as a hero. Investigators began looking at him somewhat suspiciously after the FBI received a call from a former president of a college where Jewell had once worked. He worked there as security. A deeper background search found other witnesses who claimed that he had quote unquote employment issues and an obsession with law enforcement. Once that data was leaked to a local Atlanta newspaper, the media frenzy soon followed.
I remember saying to my editor, this man's life will never be the same, simply because he said he was in the eye of this media story.
Now, there were many who had a hand in defaming Richard. Once the news sources and publications got a hold of this information, his life was forever transformed, and not for the better. Mockery, ridicule, conspiracy theories, and false assumptions were the means by which his character was almost completely destroyed.
Some of the coverage, while acknowledging that Jewell was only under investigation, still cast him in the worst possible light.
The hero may be impossible, but you get a different picture of Richard Jewell in the North Georgia mountains. He lived alone in this rented home with his Doberman dogs, both names with a green pool.
Once Richard Jewell did come in, it became very apparent over the next few weeks that there's no reason to charge him.
Richard Jewell finally got what he's been waiting for. A hand-delivered letter from the Justice Department says, based on the evidence developed to date, Jewell is not considered a target of the federal investigation.
Jewell pursued legal action against several news organizations, citing, among other things, a column that implied a comparison between Jewell and a convicted murderer, and another that called him a fat, failed former sheriff's deputy.
In the end, he sued CNN, NBC, and the New York Post, ultimately settling out of court for undisclosed amounts. But as you see, the investigation showed that there was no wrongdoing whatsoever on his part. There we go. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to get straight to the point on this one. If you're interested in further info on the Duke lacrosse case, I highly recommend the ESPN 30 for 30 documentary titled Fantastic Lies. It is a powerful and chilling documentary. This case is a textbook example of the dangers that come from making assumptions. Assumptions of guilt simply based on the ethnicities of the alleged offenders involved. Assumptions of guilt by the Gang of 88, the Duke University staff members, as well as local and national news agencies. Assumptions of guilt by DA Mike Nifong before any police report, DNA evidence, or any true investigation had even started. Assumptions of guilt by many local leaders and classmates seeking quote unquote justice and calling for the teammates to be castrated. Again, prior to any trial, prior to any evidence. All of this based solely or primarily on an allegation from one woman with a history of mental health problems and almost no corroborating evidence. The other stripper who was at the party completely denied most of the claims that were made about the events of the party. In the end, the young man were acquitted. Some of the reasons, when it was determined, once again, that DA Mike Nifong, seeking re-election, had intentionally doctored a police lineup using only photos of white Duke lacrosse team members, basically ensuring that some of them would be picked out as suspects, which completely violates, Eric, I'm sure you already know, completely violates the standards by which a police lineup is to be conducted. He also intentionally suppressed DNA evidence that would have cleared the accused team members. This ultimately led to Nifong being disbarred and facing other criminal charges. What do these events have in common? One, it demonstrates the mainstream media's ability to influence the opinions of the masses. Two, people come to conclusions about an incident without waiting for all of the facts. And if we're honest, we're all guilty of that. I'm sure at one time or another, every one of us sitting in here, oh, he looks guilty. Sandy, you love saying that, don't you, babe? Anyway. And three, personal biases influencing beliefs, which we all have to one degree or another. Are we starting to see a little bit of the pattern here, folks? Can we see how the mainstream media can influence public opinion for good or for worse? I have shown you how the popular opinion can play a role in giving us false impressions. Yes, an ugly or questionable history can be a factor, as in sometimes the ugly history of our country or even with law enforcement. It's a reality. It is what it is. And it shouldn't be ignored. But should we allow this to be the sole determining factor? Or should we go where the actual evidence leads us? In the remaining time that I have with you, I will demonstrate that the prevailing narrative on the police has oftentimes been grossly exaggerated. Oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes. And in the end, can be destructive to all sides involved. So by the numbers. So I'm gonna lay out a few facts, a few figures, a few numbers, so we can get a better picture of this entire equation. So I think it's gonna bring a whole lot of light and clarity to this entire discussion. Y'all still with me out there?
Yeah.
Good. Okay, how many cops are out there? Anyone care to take a guess how many cops you think are in the United States? Anyone bold? Don't mind being it? Okay, not bad, not a bad guess. Now, seeing how policing, there's no one governing body, it's not like the United States Army or the Navy or the Marine Corps or anything like that. So it's kind of an estimate from various sources. But it's estimated that there are anywhere between, the primary estimate is that anywhere between 500,000 and 1.5 million cops in the United States. Some would put the number even as high as 2 million. According to the National Institute of Justice, in a 2011 study, these officers conduct an average of 40 million contacts with the public annually. I believe this is referencing more likely vehicle stops, because I've seen other data, other information that puts the amount of police contacts that the officers have with the public at 100 million. And I've even heard more recently that the number was as high as 375 million, which I have a tendency to want to believe, especially in your larger areas, your larger cities. So less than 1% of these contacts, less than 1% require a use of force beyond handcuffing and low level control holds. Less than 1%. Further research conducted by the Journal of Trauma and Acute Care Surgery from March of 2018 showed that out of 1,041,737 police contacts, force was only used in 0.086% of those cases, or 1 in 1,167. Another report based on roughly 110,000 criminal arrests, force was used in 0.78% of those criminal arrests, or 1 in 128. Now, are cops out of control? Remember this. We have to remember this. 500,000, how many cops are estimated to be in the United States? 500,000 to 1.5 million, 2 million, very good. Conducting how many interactions with citizens? 40 million, 100 million, some like vehicle stops, some put even as high as 375 million contacts per year. So let's look at 2019, but before we do, I wanna make it very clear that I in no way am seeking to minimize any deaths, period. For those of us in the room who are Christ followers, especially, we should always mourn with those who mourn, or we should always mourn when a fellow image bearer of God loses his or her life. These men and women, and sometimes even children, regardless of their actions, have friends and family members who will never be the same as a result of these horrific events. Yet even with that, we must not and we cannot ignore or overlook reality when seeking to understand the details of these confrontations. We can mourn with those who mourn while at the same time strive to diligently know the truth. Simply put, for example, if you see a video of a questionable police encounter, now this doesn't mean in every police encounter, but if you see one that's questionable, maybe it only shows half of the information, there's nothing wrong with wanting to know what took place prior to the camera rolling. There could be complete justification for what you saw. Maybe there was justification, maybe it was completely unjustified, but asking that question should be our desire. Nor should you be made to feel guilty for asking that question, wondering what happened. Proverbs 18:2 tells us that a fool takes no delight in understanding, but only in airing his own opinion. My prayer is that we would never take the path of the fool. Okay, back to 2019. We're going to dig deeper into some more solid numbers. As of the time of me updating this information, which was just about a week ago, according to the Washington Post, the police killed 999 people in 2019, total. Approximately 2 million cops, upwards of 375 million contacts, roughly 1,000 deaths. The ethnic breakdown, 403 were white, 250 were black, 162 Hispanic, 143 were unknown as of the time of the reporting, 41 were other. Oftentimes, the initial response is to assume some level of bias or racism because blacks make up only 13% of the population. And it's easy to come to that conclusion, especially once again, when we figure in or consider the oftentimes ugly history of law enforcement. Yes, we should be willing to deal with that possibility. We must also be open and honest enough to deal with cultural differences within small segments of various groups. For instance, men, we make up less than 50% of the population. But how much of the prison system do you think we make up? 93%. Less than 50% of the population, men make up over 93% of the U.S. prison population. Now, should we make the assumption that men are being unfairly treated? Or could there be something else going on? Could men be more aggressive at times? And would that be unreasonable to consider that that may be the issue with different groups within our nation? All I'm doing is just asking you to consider different facts. That's all I'm asking you to do. Is bias or bigotry the reason for this disparity? Is it possible? Yes. Is it possible that there are other factors? Absolutely. When we further examine these numbers regarding the amount of shootings that took place in 2019 that takes place within any police interaction over the years, other studies show that 85% of all police shootings involved armed suspects. 85%. I think we sometimes forget, and to me, especially the things that we're seeing in the news lately, that we forget that the police aren't about delivering flowers and giving out scoops of ice cream. They deal with what? Crime, criminals. And oftentimes these men and women will come face to face with evil, sometimes on a daily basis. According to the Washington Post also, and here's the breakdown. Out of those 999 shootings, 55 were unarmed. Again, I'm not trying to claim that those 55 lives were irrelevant. 599 had guns, 172 had knives, 64 were in control of a vehicle, and a vehicle can easily be used as a weapon. 29 had fake or toy guns, and in a low light and high stress situation, it can sometimes be tough to decipher a real gun from a fake one, especially when you're expected oftentimes to make split-second decisions. 60 had other weapons, could be clubs, screwdrivers, rocks, sticks, bricks, bottles. 924 out of these 999 were in possession of a real or fake weapon. Now, this is a topic that I really love digging into, because oftentimes you hear unarmed, and I really want to dig into this and bring a little more reality to this debate. In every police-related encounter, there are potential weapons, and those weapons are the ones possessed by the officer. And on average, every year, around 7% of all officer-involved deaths, the suspect took control of the officer's weapon and killed him with it. About every year, 7 to 10% every year. The Census Bureau also stated that in 2017, 716 people were killed by what is known as personal weapons: punches, kicks, knee strikes, elbow strikes, so on and so forth. They were physically killed. No weapon in the picture. And if you add strangulation, asphyxiation, and suffocation, the number of lives lost rise closer to 1,000 every year, per the FBI Uniform Crime Report. Are things as bad as they were 30, 40, 50 years ago? Some of the common vernacular terminologies or terms that you'll hear today during this whole discussion is that the police killings of black men is an epidemic. And I really want to dig into that a little deeper. In 2015, there were 38 unarmed black men killed by the police. Did I go past it? There we go. 2016, there were 19. So 2015, there were 38. 2016, 19. These are all unarmed black men that were killed by the police. In 2017, there were 21. 2018, 17. 2019, there were 13. And this is all from the Washington Post database. Even in that short period of time, in that 5-year period, we already see a clear and substantial reduction in the number of deaths. You're looking at more than 50% that has taken place in that short period of time. And remember the number of cops that are out there on the beat. Remember that number. That plays a role. If there was, and this is just me talking, I'm winging it here. I'm giving my personal opinion. If there was an, let me move on here. I said I was gonna stay on track. I said I was gonna stay on track and I'm gonna do my best. Like I said, remember cops, there are nearly 2 million cops in this country who are making tens of millions or even hundreds of millions of contacts every single year. According to the Center on Juvenile and Criminal Justice, an organization that isn't known for necessarily being pro or pro-police or conservative or anything like that, while noting the often wide disparity, because their argument that they're making in this report, they're trying to make the argument that the police kill blacks and minorities at a disproportionate rate. But even in this study, while noting the disparity, they recognize that the overall rate of police killings of blacks has fallen by 70% over the last 40 to 50 years. It also states that even with the young black youth population and young adult population doubling over the last 40 years, the police shootings of young black men 25 and under has fallen nearly 80%. The same report notes that police-related deaths from cops towards black men has declined overall by 61% since the 1960s. No, I'm not celebrating these numbers. Once again, any death is a tragedy. Yet I ask you to ask yourself this, does this sound like an epidemic? Just consider that. And how often have you heard this information that I'm sharing with you? And if it hasn't been often, or if you've never heard it, ask yourself why. Folks, we have only touched the tip of the iceberg with the facts that I could have shared with you today. I had to cut out a ton of information for the sake of time. The unfortunate reality is that when there's an unfounded mistrust, I'm talking about unfounded mistrust of the police. And I'm not saying that cops haven't done things in the past to deserve some of the mistrust that we have gotten over the years. But when there's an unfounded mistrust, there are many possible victims. Ultimately, the ones who will suffer the most are those who live in the very communities who need police protection the most. When us blacks run or fight or resist the police, or when we refuse to call the police because we assume they don't have our best interests at heart, or that they are excessively dangerous and violent, who suffers the most? I believe it's very obvious. My friends, this is no small issue. My goal today was to give you some things to think about or consider wherever you may stand on some of the issues dealing with police brutality. Proverbs 18 and 17 says, "The one who states his case first seems right until the other comes and examines him." My hope and prayer is as we struggle through these oftentimes complex issues, that above all things, we would be truth seekers first, putting aside our own personal opinions in order to better determine the facts from the fiction. Thank you.
So Eric, please stay up there. We're gonna take some questions.
Awesome. I'm gonna grab a seat. I'm gonna get a chair here.
Yeah, please feel free.
Not in the drums here. I'm not that talented.
Okay. So. I'll get you a chair.
All right.
So if you have a question, please feel free to text it to me at 702-326-1642, and I will present the question.
Thank you.
To Eric. What a great presentation. Thanks so much. I hate that you felt rushed. We could listen to it all day because there's such great information there. Thanks for that. Thanks for your slides. Thanks for your presentation and hard work on this. I hope you found it informative, but let's talk some questions. This one's from me, actually, and I didn't write this down, so I'm just going to say what's on my mind a little bit about it. Could you speak to the George Floyd incident? Because I know you put a video out on Code Red Conversations, and I think that would be helpful for us, because that's, you know, a lot of these things have happened, and it seems like, culturally speaking, that was almost like the straw that broke the camel's back with a lot of the things that have happened. So could you just speak to that, whether it's 5 minutes or whether it's 3 minutes or whether it's 30 seconds? But I think it would be very helpful for us to hear your thoughts on what happened with that.
Yeah, well, I think that what happened to George Floyd was pretty much universally panned as horrific, to say the least. I don't know too many people. I may have run across one person that tried to justify what took place. But amongst my law enforcement officer, my officer friends, my civilian friends, average citizens, everybody, I'm all about evidence. I always talk about waiting to get all the facts before you jump to a conclusion. But for me, especially being a firearms and defensive tactics instructor, I didn't need to see anything else. What Chauvin did, that was horrific. Now, I know there are other factors that are involved, the medical conditions, the issues he had that were related to his death. But the idea of putting your knee on someone's neck for almost nine minutes, was utterly insane. And I recall crying out to the camera, like, get off of him. And I know it was a day late, but I literally yelled out to the camera, like, what are you doing, man? Because it was just a ignorant and stupid and foolish tactic event. And I know there were so many things that were involved in it. Because as information came more clear, you had, you hear other officers say that they were telling him to get off of him, but he wouldn't. And I really struggle with, this is the one that gets me, because I point out how everyone almost unanimously understood that was an evil and a horrific event. And most cops that I know are at least open to the idea that policing needs to improve. We can always get better. Would you agree, Eric?
Yes.
We pretty much all agree on that. There's always room for improvement. But what bothers me personally in regard to that whole event is the assumption that's often made that racism is involved. Like, that's the go-to. Is it possible that Chauvin was just an idiot? I mean, I'm being honest, and I'm not trying to cater to anybody, whatever the case may be. As a Christ follower in particular, my desire isn't to go with how I feel. That's not my main focus. My main focus is to try to honor the one who is the author of truth, wherever that may take us. And that may take us into places that we're not used to going. And I know, as a black man, born and raised in the United States, I know that there's some scars in our country, and they're hard to overcome. And some of these things, and then if you add to the fact that sometimes you have a media who wants to poke and prod at that to make it even worse, to keep us angry. And I think there are a lot of reasons why, and I can go on and on about that. I can do another 30 minutes talking about that topic. But I understand that there are a lot of issues there, and there are people there who use these scars, these wounds, to keep us angry and to keep us frustrated. But I would like to question and challenge everyone out there that we need to dig deeper. It's easy and simple, and often to assume race is the motive. It's an easy way out, in my opinion. Let's dig deeper and find out the truth. Now, if more details and more information comes out and we find out that Chauvin was a racist and there's documented proof, then let's consider that. But just because a black person has been victimized by someone who's white, we should not just assume that racism is the primary motivation. But that's all you hear. That's all you hear these days. Turn on the news. That's all you hear. Racism, racism, racism. I'm tired of hearing that. I'm just saying, I'm frustrated with that, because I understand that sin lies in the heart of every man as a Christian, and that we all wrestle with things, but not everyone wrestles with the same sin. So.
Thank you. We have a few questions coming in through the text. One of them you answered already relates to the training that police officers go through, and you just answered that in the previous comments that there's always room for improvement.
Always.
Another question is what do we say to somebody who, and I'm not sure where the questioner is coming with this, but what do you say if you're engaging someone and they are doubting that the numbers are legitimate?
I get that often.
Do you? Okay.
So yeah, I get that
how often. Do you handle that when somebody challenges your research or the statistics that you give?
Then I would oftentimes ask them what the burden of proof is on them to prove otherwise. Okay. Because when it's all said and done, everyone takes someone's information, whether it's anecdotal evidence, as in, Kevin, you tell me about something that took place to you. We all listen to something. So primarily those people who are out there who are assuming that the numbers are questionable or false. And if you notice, a lot of the data sources I gave were from various sources, Center for Disease Control, the FBI Uniform Crime Report, the Washington Post. I picked tons of sources that weren't conservative or right-leaning, whatever the case may be, CDC, various sources, various studies, because I'm trying to give an even-keeled approach to it. Even the Washington Post, a liberal-leaning, left-leaning organization, now I'm not trying to make it political, but we all know in a reality that we're living in, there is a discussion and a debate, conservative and liberal. It's right before us all the time. And there are opinions that come from people who lean more left as there are people who lean more right. So what I would always ask them to do is, what information do you have that counteracts that? And just ask them to be truthful and examine the information. But when you're dealing with information that comes from a variety of sources, people from various backgrounds and viewpoints, it's hard to really overcome that information. That's why I made the slide like I did, the whole presentation the way that I did. So I would suggest that whoever is wanting to give some information would just give a little more, make sure their information, their data is from a wide variety of sources.
It sounds like the questioner has encountered people that dispute statistics.
I'm sure everyone in here probably has.
So, could you speak a little bit to the reaction that has occurred after the fact, really after the George Floyd incident, with the riots, the protests, the entire movement behind that? Could you speak a few minutes to that, please?
Yeah.
Your thoughts on it.
Yeah, my thoughts are, and I kind of touched on it a little bit when I talked about how overall people were open and willing, and most people said, yeah, there are problems here. These things, there's some issues here that definitely need to be addressed, and we're open to that. And that was a perfect opportunity for unity, and it was universally had. But then you had other people who came in, agitators. So I think protests are a beautiful thing, and it's a blessing, a gift that we're allowed as American citizens. But then you had people who came in who were seeking to agitate and cause conflict and cause chaos. And this whole movement of defunding and abolishing the police, I think that's absolutely insane. And we're seeing what happens as a result of that. All you have to do is look at, what's it called, CHOP now or CHAZ? The amount of chaos that takes, when the people, for anyone who may not know, when they have that what do they call it? That, well, that's one thing they say, that opportunity zone or autonomous zone, yes. They call it autonomous zone in Washington, in Seattle. And you see all the chaos that's taking place up there. These people have this ideology that abolish and defund the police, and no police are allowed, but you're already having killings, you're having sexual assaults, you're having all kinds of crime going on in there. And what was the question again? Because I wanted, there was a point.
Just your general, just a question related to your general, thoughts on the riots,
right.
You're answering it, and even maybe if you want to share some thoughts in general on the Black Lives Matter movement.
Yeah, well, let me touch on this topic first. Here is the fact that when we looked already, we see problems in the police community. We see issues, areas of improvement, major problems, some more significant than others. Training issues. As a police trainer, someone who's actually had cops, took them to the range, taught them DTs, I can tell you that there are times where you have cops that are complacent. that don't really care about training because they see it as an inconvenience. That's a real issue. It used to frustrate me to no end. There are officers out there who don't care about improving, and my frustration would come oftentimes from, my man, you carry a gun on you 40 hours a week, and you wear body armor when you come to your job. Who does that? What percentage of the population does that for a living? So you better consider your physical fitness, you better consider your tools, and you can't just be a baton and a gun. You have to have more. You have to be able to go hands-on. Coming from my background, my corrections background, I was always a guy that liked to go hands-on first. If things escalate, I'd rather use the appropriate amount of force or the minimal force necessary to take it under control. Now, there were times where I had to go draw down on someone. By the grace of God, I never had to shoot anyone. I had to kill anybody. Thank the Lord for that. But I didn't understand that there might come a time where I had to go there. But if I didn't, I wanted to make sure that my skill set was broad enough to where, and if it wasn't a physical thing, nothing gave me more pleasure than being able to talk a tense situation down. Nothing.
We have a question that came in. Actually, I think it's a comment. There's just mentioning a book by Heather McDonald on police officers, lots of facts, statistics that tend to also dispute some of the mainstream media reporting.
Yeah, the book's titled The War on Cops. Excellent resource. And it just offers an example because she gathers a ton of information and data from various sources. She actually went out into these communities and had conversations and discussions with different people in order to get a better understanding. And it just counteracts a lot of the mainstream narrative that we're getting.
So once again, it's Heather McDonald, and the book's title is?
The War on Cops.
The War on Cops. Okay, thank you. Follow-up question. Could you speak to any impact of any correlation of a lack of a father figure with prison inmates in general?
Well, I don't have any exact numbers and stats and figures, but it's pretty much common knowledge. Even Barack Obama, during one of his speeches, spoke on how there's a greater likelihood for a young man or even a young woman. For a young woman, she has a greater likelihood of becoming pregnant without the father in the home. And young people have a greater likelihood of dropping out of school, greater likelihood of suffering from mental health disease, becoming hooked on some kind of drug or alcohol, and a much greater likelihood to end up in prison when the father isn't in the home. And you asked me to reference Black Lives Matter, and that's one of the many issues as a Christian where I struggle to say that I can rock with those guys, if I could just talk plainly to you. Because part of their primary motivation is the dismantling of the quote-unquote nuclear family. And you're talking about a father, and you can go, and don't believe me, just go on the website, look it up for yourself. And one of the main areas that blacks are negatively influenced the most, when you look at the single-parent home rate in the area of 70%. So you mean to tell me, I always say that in order for us to get a better understanding of these issues, and it steps on a lot of toes and makes a lot of people uncomfortable, but I just want to be real, and I want to really address these issues fairly and wholly. We have to be willing to acknowledge, and I kind of touched on it during the presentation, but we have to be willing to acknowledge the inordinate amount of crime in certain aspects of different communities. And I want to speak on the black community in particular. I'm a black man, as everyone could plainly see, and I worked in the prison system, the county jail, patrolled the streets. And this isn't a wholesale paint a broad brush over anybody, but there's a small segment of less than 6%, and particularly black men, there's a small segment who are responsible for an overwhelming amount of crime in certain areas, over 50% of the homicides. And this is not just one year, this is consistently. Over 50% of the robberies and approximately 40% of the violent crime in the nation. And if we want to have a fair discussion, now poverty, all these other fatherless homes, all these other things play a role. But in order to have a fair and balanced approach in this discussion, in this debate, We have to be willing to look at every aspect, every part of what's going on in the culture in order to say, how do we fix this thing? And if all you want to do is just say, well, just get the government, to get them to give people more money, that's just not being realistic. There have been over $20 trillion that has been pumped into poverty programs since the 1960s. $20 trillion. And we see things are only getting progressively worse. So there has to be other means by which we can fix these issues. That's just my personal perspective.
There's another question that came through back to the George Floyd issue related to your thoughts on the degree of culpability of the other officers that were present.
I think that when things get to the point to where you see a tactic is being abused, there is something, what's the term off the top of my head, in relation to another officer's culpability, as far as when, Eric, you know what I'm talking about? When? Yeah, there's a certain term. I was just talking about it just a couple of days ago, but that'll probably come to me when we're all done, most likely. But there is clear, if there's something, and I'm sure any officer in here, I know Eric can go along with me on this. When you see an officer lose it, he loses his cool. He gets out of control. You got to get in there. I often use the term, I have a video with me and one of my old sergeants talking about this issue. When you see another cop getting out of hand, you got to bow guard your way in there. I got him, man. Because you're saving everyone involved. It's potentially saving that officer's career, but even more so, you're potentially saving this individual, suspect, citizen, whoever he may be, from getting hurt. And there has to be that level of understanding that I'm equally responsible. And here in Metro, they have a policy that if you see something go down and you don't get involved, that you're culpable and you could lose your job just as easily as the other individual. So there's clear, so it relies on everybody because we're expected to protect and serve. The citizenry doesn't expect us to abuse our authority, and they shouldn't have to deal with that.
I'm actually shocked from looking at that video over and over.
Right.
That one of the officers didn't just push that guy off.
Right.
You talk to him first, then it's over. Well, all you do is you ask him once, hey, get off him right now. The guy's handcuffed. That's another thing people don't realize. He's handcuffed.
Absolutely.
He's totally mobilized.
Totally insane.
Is done with bicep, okay? It's done with your arms, it's done with your body. So I was shocked that, so to answer your question, I believe those officers should be charged.
Absolutely.
A question
related to, how as Christians can we be part of the solution?
I would say I believe that everything that we see in our culture, in our society, and Pastor, I'd love to get your perspective. I'm gonna keep my response brief. But I believe that every issue we see in our society is a sin issue. Every problem we see is a sin issue. Police, when you have police officers who are abusive with their authority, with their power, it's a heart issue. I believe when you're dealing with racism, when you're dealing with bigotry, it's a heart issue. We as believers need to know what we believe, why we believe it, and be able to articulate the gospel and be able to defend 1 Peter 3:15, what we believe. We need to be able to defend clearly why we believe Christianity to be the truth, not a means by which someone could be saved, but the way that God has chosen to save people, save mankind. We need to be able to be clear and be able to articulate that and allow the Holy Spirit, allow God to do his part in saving people and changing their hearts.
I think that's a great note to end on. And I don't have anything to add to that. That's amazing. So thanks so much for joining us today. Thanks for your questions. Thanks for those watching online. Big thank you to Eric Muldrow. God bless. Thanks. If you may have more questions that you specifically, maybe privately want to ask Eric, or email him later, or call him later, talk to him after the seminar, and set that up if you would like to have more conversations with him. I also, again, would like to, again, just let you know about his YouTube channel, Code Red Conversations, specific videos about a lot of these issues. I'm only about maybe a third of the way through, so there's some great ones, and I would encourage you to consider some of those if you have some specific questions or some topics that maybe you would like to hear more. So thanks again to Eric. Thanks for being with us. God bless. Thanks for being here. God bless.